And we are here at the Linux World Conference and Expo, and I'm speaking with
Patrick Bernstad. This is probably about the fifth Linux World Expo that's been held. Linux World started 2 years ago. The first one was held down at the Santa Clara Valley Convention Center in San Jose. 6 months later, another one was held down there, and in the intervening time, why, one has been held at the Jarvis Center in New York, one in Europe, and upon returning to the West Coast, where they no longer fit into the San Jose Civic Center, so they have rented the north portion of Moscone Hall and appear to have quite a good crowd going. Definitely need this amount of room.
What brings the interest to Linux? What's piquing the interest of folks in Linux?
I think that in truth, there are two basic things that get people interested in Linux. One is you can truly get hands-on. And for a programmer, especially when it comes to systems languages, this is a very rare treat where you can actually get source code. You can pretty much divine what people were thinking of when they originally designed it and that. As a benefit, it's also free. And that gives a nice feeling, which leads into the other thing that I continually get positive comments on is the feeling of community. And a couple of events in the last couple of weeks have kind of brought this to the surface of just what on one hand, a totally unorganized, anarchic type of an organization is, but how high their moral standards are and how compassionate they are. The incident I'm thinking of is one of the editors of one of the magazines was posting disparaging remarks about his competitors under pseudonyms on other news groups, which, you know, this is not terribly unusual in business or in human interactions, but the Linux community was appalled. They thought that was just a major breach of trust and something that was just ethically unacceptable.
There was one of the gentlemen was mentioning that there was going to be a march outside the Moscone Center here on Thursday. And what is that in reference to?
Okay, this is in reference to, and it's called the Free Dmitry March. Dmitry's, and I'll murder his last name like everybody else does, but Dmitry Skarloff, I believe, is a Russian programmer, about a mid-level programmer, who came over from Moscow to a convention in Las Vegas to give a presentation on a little bit of program that he had written that could read e-books, electronic books, that had been encoded using the Adobe proprietary encoding script. When he was getting on the airplane, literally checking out from the hotel to get on the airplane, the FBI grabbed him at the checkout desk and handcuffed him and hauled him off. Took him to Oklahoma, had him in prison in Oklahoma for 2 weeks before they moved him up here to San Jose to arraign him. The charge was that he had violated the DCMA, the Digital Copyright Manipulation Act. I don't know exactly what the M is for, but a horrendous, terrible piece of literature that was eased through the U.S. Congress during the Lewinsky hearings and the grand Clinton impeachment thing, and this is what slimed in under the door in the meantime. Basically, probably the cut to the bottom line is if you do anything that violates the profit-making capacities of the corporations or the publishers of it, you're in the wrong. And the librarians in particular have been fighting this because it restricts the reuse for educational purposes almost entirely. It was never very favorably received by the programming community. And this really has brought things to a head because Dmitry was arraigned down in San Jose, and then he was bailed out and has been staying with a fellow down there. The march on Thursday is going to be in support of him. It's going to be from Moscone Center to the Federal Center. Originally, the timing was that he was to have a preliminary hearing at that time, but that's been postponed, but the march hasn't. So that's going to happen.
What are some of the other issues that have brought you or piqued your interest in the Linux conference?
Well, I've been pretty much watching Linux ever since it was first created 10 years ago, and it started out as a really good idea. It was one of those things when Linus Torvalds, who is the father, if you will, of Linux, when he first published on Usenet to try and create this Unix-like but free and open operating system, there were a whole lot of people worldwide that said, yes, that's a great idea. We've been hoping for something like this for a long time, and there have been literally tens of thousands of people who have contributed to the effort. Many people worked together for 2 or 3 years, hundreds of hours, over the Internet, and never met each other in person until the Linux World conferences started happening. And very out front, frank-based people that have a lot of compassion and a lot of sense of values and are trying to create a product in a price range that can be used by anybody anywhere.
And that is free.
That's about the only thing that fits in Ecuador and in Chad and places like that. Even $25 is a ridiculously large amount of money to have to spend for something that you can't fry, boil, or saute. The other thing that I think is really important is the fact that anybody can contribute to the development of this. And as you know, there's no way of getting a sense of ownership than to actually work on a project. And then you know, on one hand, you know that you would love to have it perfect, but you can also say, oh, yes, that little wart over there, we meant to get rid of that, you know. How would you like to do that? And this is very much the way this thing works. Linus Torvalds was so refreshing to hear him talk and say, I did it because I didn't want to do all this work. And I wasn't that good at some of it, so share it, you know. Yeah.
We're here at the Linux World Conference and Expo, the Expo 2001 in San Francisco. A little bit later, we're going to go to some of the copyright issues that are coming up with open source versus proprietary source code. We're at the
Microtech
site, and I had a couple questions about the proprietary aspects of Linux, which was open source coding, and how that is transitioning to where different people are making it more proprietary.
With respect to Linux, Linux is open source, and as a open source license, the way the open source license works, any attempt to add code to Linux requires that code also be open source. That's part of the open source licensing methodology, and it's part of GNU licensing, it's part of Free Software Foundation, and things of that nature.
So maybe you could explain a little bit about how that works, how the open source then becomes proprietary?
The open source itself doesn't become proprietary. What happens is I can write product to put on an open source system, and then I can sell that product as proprietary product. But I cannot add code to the open source system without it becoming open source as well. The end user product that is not physically part of the operating system can be written. I can have a third-party product that you can use on Linux, and that product can be of my own code, okay, and it can be a completely proprietary tool, and I can sell it as proprietary code. But if I include any of the code that is part of open source, okay, then I can't sell that code as anything other than open source. For example, if I made an enhancement to the GNU compiler, okay, that enhancement would become free software. If I made an enhancement to the Linux operating system, that would have to become open source. I can write a driver for a piece of hardware that works on the Linux operating system, and it could be completely proprietary. The deal there is it is simply a piece of code that the Linux operating system uses to accomplish access to a particular piece of hardware. With Windows in general, the operating system is wholly owned and wholly manufactured and taken care of by the Microsoft folks. You pay your license fee, you can run Windows. Okay, you didn't get it for free. Okay, and any third-party products you buy. Specifically from the vendor that provides them. The difference is that if you buy like Microsoft tools like Office 2000, There's the general view that Microsoft knows things internally about its own operating system and uses those to its advantage to create a better tool on Windows than any third-party vendor can. In the Linux workspace, everybody has a free access to the same interface to the operating system. And what that generally means is that any third party you buy a piece of software from has the same opportunity to develop the great, wonderful, you know, do-all to end-all to be-all app that any other third party has. It's not confined to the Redmond, Washington area. So there's an interesting way of looking at it. I hope that answers your question.
Right. We're speaking with
Joe Devine. I'm with Migratech in Dallas, Texas.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we're sitting in front of Damon News, and we're speaking with
Don Witt.
And Don Witt was just explaining to me a little bit about BSD operating system, and maybe he could give us some background on where it comes from and how it's been used in other operating systems and the differences between it and Linux.
Well, to start with, the BSD itself stands for Berkeley Software Distribution. And going back about 20 years, was developed at the University of California, Berkeley campus. So it has quite a history. It is currently the basis for HP's UX, IBM's AIX. Apple just introduced their operating system, OS X, which is also based on BSD. And Sun's original OS was based on BSD. Currently, Microsoft is using their TCPI stack in NT is based on, it is the BSD TCPIP stack. And let's see, what else do we have? They are releasing their .NET to the open source community on two platforms. One is their own and the other is FreeBSD. So I think that there's actually a shift that's in the process going on here. Linux is a very, you know, it's has the limelight right now, but there's a lot of people out there looking for something that's better, and a lot of people are becoming more aware of BSD because of Apple's introduction of the of their OS X. This is actually a very sensitive subject, and I don't want to step on anybody's toes here, but BSD does have a very regimented release process, number one. There's 200 committers that review code prior to it getting in, and when they review it for the quality of code to make sure it's consistent with the BSD tradition, that is well-documented, well-structured, conforms to the OSI model. Then when it gets added to the kernel, it goes through an extensive beta test. So if it hasn't gone through enough of a beta test at the next release, they'll hold back modules and put them into the next release. So number one, you have a very solid, generally speaking, a very stable operating system upon release. And modules that worked in a previous release will work in the current release. The other thing, which is a primary differentiating point, is the GPL, the licensing. People that compile code into Linux kernel, it becomes open source for the most part, and or maybe a gray area if it does or doesn't. With BSD, there is no issues there. That's one of the major reasons why Apple has selected it, HP and IBM as well.
When you say there is no gray area, what are you referring to?
Well, when, for example, if Apple now, they are based on BSD, any code that some of their vendors who provide commercial communications products, they'll need to develop drivers that get compiled into the kernel. There is no problem with their sale commercially of that code and or it becoming open source.
So is BSD open source?
It is open source, but there is no licensing issue as far as commercially using BSD.
Except that in order to get a BSD operating system, you have to get it through a vendor who has made it proprietary.
No. You can download it free off the Internet.
If someone wanted to download it off the Internet, where would they go?
There's several different versions of BSD that are available today. You have FreeBSD, which is, for the most part, the baseline of the BSD platforms. Then you have OpenBSD, which is secure from the time you install. So as soon as you bring up your system after the installation, it is a secure operating system. Then you also have NetBSD, which is an operating system that will work on virtually any platform that's out there, including Macintosh, and it's a huge list of hardware that it'll run with. And there's a lot of advantages to that one, specifically that, number one, you have one operating system that will install on all of those platforms. Number two, when a vendor develops his drivers to the operating system, those drivers are developed for all of the others as well. And there's only one install. So netbsd.org, freebsd.org, or openbsd.org.
And once again, we're speaking with
Don Witt of the Damon News.
And this is Govinda here at the Linux World Conference and Expo 2001. Thank you. And I'm sitting with
Richard Shesonia.
And Richard, where are you from?
Well, I'm from Nigeria, Lagos. I'm from Lagos in Nigeria. That's West Africa.
What brings you here to this computer conference?
Well, as a matter of fact, Linux in Nigeria is an operating system that, although it's new, is gathering a lot of momentum due to, really, its price benefit and stability. The reason I'm here, basically, is to try and see what inroads we can make to establish Linux training and promotion back in Nigeria.
When you mentioned the cost, could you explain to folks how costs may be different from a Linux operating system as opposed to Microsoft or Macintosh?
Well, a typical example would be not only the cost of the operating system, but the application that sits on top of it as well. Now, as far as operating system, Windows NT or 2000 server, for instance, I know you would pay nothing less than $500 for it or somewhere around there. And for Linux, at least Red Hat, you probably don't have to pay anything. Or for licenses, maybe about $100 at the most. Now, on the other hand, for applications, if you look at sort of applications you would get and the equivalent on Windows, a typical example would be the IBM Small Business Suite, which goes for $499. On Windows, the same application would cost about $4,000. And there are sort of differentials that can make a major difference in moving the open source movement along in a place like Nigeria. You know, and of course, all the other factors that go with it, like stability, availability, scalability, you know, all those key issues that go with Linux. And of course, service providers would find it extremely, extremely handy to serve web pages and all the kind of other services that they would provide to grow the internet space in Nigeria, as it were. I see an opportunity for Linux in the sense that provided adequate training and support is on the ground, companies would certainly take a look at it, and that would be the start to sort of move the whole Linux movement along in a place like Nigeria. Some companies have started user groups. Some are already providing Red Hat training. But I don't think that is enough at this time. It's a start, but we can certainly do a lot better than that.
If folks that were listening to this program were interested in supporting your efforts, how would they get in touch with you?
Well, a number of ways, but the easiest would be by email. And you can email us at info@avancesystems.com, which is AVANCESYSTEMS.com.
So one of the biggest impacts that Linux would have is because it would cost so much less to actually get the operating system and then the software, the systems that are laid on top of that.
Yeah. Yes, that would certainly have an impact. But the other thing that one could also look at would be to bundle Linux with with hardware, what I would call PC clones, to just bring down the cost, or in fact any other PC Intel based. And I think promotions like that would get a lot of companies and individuals to take a second look at Linux, to move Linux in an emerging market or as a case study for an emerging market. Anytime such things are looked at, you find that there's always that road, or like a stumbling block of trying to get it right as far as people being trained, the correct type of software, and compatibility with other systems. And, of course, the exchange rates, you know, fluctuating and being so disparate, you find that the banks really have to come up to speed on not only, you know, how to implement these technologies, but, you know, they have to know the right technologies to use as we look at all the smart card solutions.
So your focus is mainly on infrastructure development so that commerce can become more a simpler project.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, that is where we're looking at. We started out with messaging, basically, but obviously now we're looking at the whole infrastructure that's going to tie it all up together and make it all work out. As far as e-business, e-business infrastructure especially, I think part of the problems we have, or we have always had, it has to do with training and awareness. And if we could get over that and provide support for our products, including the underlying operating system, I think the sky is the limit. The only other thing that obviously has to be looked at in more detail is ensuring that we get enough computers hardware. Yeah, because the price is sometimes out of the reach of a lot of companies and individuals.
What is the language spoken in Nigeria?
Well, the lingua franca is English. All the major tribes speak English, but there are three major tribes: Yoruba, Hausa, and Igbo. But ordinarily, all the tribes are fluent in English or a version of English called vernacular, or what you call broken English. Yeah, so, but it works as long as...
Okay, well, thank you very much. And once again, we're speaking with...
Richard Chasonya of Avan Systems in Nigeria, Lagos.
Thank you. I'm speaking with...
Don Rosenberg.
Don Rosenberg. And what is your affiliation or your group here?
My company is Stromian Technologies. I do software licensing between software companies, OEM software licensing, getting software A inside software B.
Could you say that one more time?
Getting one piece of software incorporated into another piece of software.
And then dealing with the legal ramifications of the proprietary aspects of that?
Yes. I'm not a lawyer. I do the business issues. My focus is making sure the deal gets done. And, of course, I have to know enough about licensing and law and contracts to make sure that things work out all right. People usually have their attorneys look at the arrangements.
Okay. One of the things that's come up is looking at this specific event is the open source codes of Linux and then the proprietary sort of end-user programs that are put together. And you had mentioned something about the DMCA law, and maybe you could go into that a little bit.
The Digital Millennium Copyright Act is a very hot issue at the moment. It's the law that provides... for the fact that if you take a technological protection device, it could be software code, to protect your intellectual property, anyone who defeats that or attempts to defeat it is guilty of a felony. And this makes a great many people annoyed because you can no longer reverse engineer for compatibility, which is allowed under copyright law. One of the ironies of the DMCA is it recognizes fair use under copyright law. It enumerates a number of fair uses, but practically speaking, you can't exercise that fair use without breaking the law, that is, without defeating the technological protection. For instance, the electronic books that the license says you cannot read aloud to your children, the electronic books that you can't loan to a friend or that expire after a certain point, you can't copy a few pages because they're all locked up. All of these fair use arrangements are effectively prevented by the technology.
Dmitry, I believe that's the gentleman's name from Russia.
Yes. I can't say a lot about Dmitry because I am concerned that he may very well be convictable of violating the DMCA. I don't know all the ins and outs of it. However, it's an interesting case. Personally, although I regret any pain to Dmitry, I would like to see it come forward to trial so people can find out just how bad the law is and do something about it. The only bodies that can do anything about it are the U.S. Congress and Supreme Court at this point. So it's going to have to assume a very high profile before anything happens.
Where did this law originate?
Basically, with the intellectual property barons who control the entertainment industry, they were concerned about Napster-like copying, and electronic books are coming along. Once you digitize something, it's extremely easy to copy and distribute. So they were looking for legal teeth that would enforce the technological means of preventing copying and distribution. And basically, that's what this law does. It says that any sort of technology lock, no matter how feeble, is sacrosanct and can't be violated.
What are some of the other issues that revolve around the copyright issues or the proprietary rights from, you know, software that interfaces within other software programs?
Well, just coming back to copyright, the Sonny Bono Copyright Act extended copyrights considerably. Originally, they were 17 years, and then there was a provision to extend them an additional renewal period of 17 years. So you had a total of 34 years. But the intellectual property barons have pushed Congress to the point where they extend out beyond a century now. You may have heard of the parody someone did of Gone with the Wind from the slave's point of view called The Wind Done Gone. And the copyright holders for Gone with the Wind went into court to prevent that, saying that it was a derivative work of Gone with the Wind. That would never have been an issue if copyright hadn't been pushed out so far because that work was done practically 70 years ago. The only works coming now into public domain are about 1922, which means that a lot of our great American 20th century literature, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, and so on, is still under copyright, so that you won't find it up on Project Gutenberg, and you can't distribute it to your friends, and the Dover people won't be publishing it. The digital transmission or digital form of any intellectual property means that it can be very easily distributed. It also means it can be easily protected, at least legally, so that you can tell what's happening. Under current laws, if you publish a book and someone buys a copy, after that he's free to loan it, he's free to resell it. All of these things now can be controlled if the property is digital and you put the software locks on it. An example of that are the DVDs that if you buy them in Europe won't work in a machine that's intended to run in America. What's interesting with digital television is that they're going to do things such as you can control the you can record the program as long as you're watching it on the same machine you recorded it on, but you can't pass the recording. Whereas now it's perfectly legal to, I believe, to tape a show and to share the tape with your friends. Open source licenses are all based on copyright law. The person who controls the copyright controls the licensing. So without copyright law, there is no open source, although they may call it copyleft. And in a way, as a plan by Richard Stallman, it's supposed to subvert copyright, but there wouldn't be any copyleft if there weren't copyright. So the government expects basically all property to be accounted for. It's something like land. You don't find any piece of land that is not the property of someone, and if you haven't paid the taxes on it, it's on its way to becoming state property, at least until it's auctioned and has another owner. And intellectual property tends to follow this same path. And if you put something out truly in the public domain, you have to sign documents to that effect saying that it's public, and someone can pick it up and make a minor modification to it, and suddenly it's proprietary again. So the open source licenses, especially the free licenses such as the GNU General Public License, are intended to make sure that the property stays out in the open and quite free. Well, the famous license is the GNU General Public License from Richard Stallman's Free Software Foundation. It's the license that covers the Linux kernel and much of the software that forms a Linux system. The other big license is an open source license called BSD, and it is very simple because the general public license requires you to pass on the source code, but the BSD license says once you've received the program, including the source code, you can make any modification or change you want and redistribute, and you don't have to redistribute the source code. So some people feel that this is more generous. Some people feel this is playing into the hands of proprietary people like Bill Gates, who actually has taken BSD networking code and put it into Windows NT.
I also understand that the Macintosh OS 10 is BSD-based.
Down at the fundamental level, yes, it is based on that code. With the BSD license, you can close the code at any time when you distribute it, so that you have to go back to where it came from to find the original source. You can make your own proprietary changes to it, and it's perfectly legal. This, of course, is what gets the goat of Richard Stallman and why he wants to make sure that this stuff stays publicly available, and that's the whole point of the GNU General Public License.
If people are a little annoyed, so to speak, with this kind of move towards the proprietary implementation of laws like the DMCA, what can they do? Who would they contact? What is the strategy?
Well, when it comes to the copyright laws, the Sonny Bono Act and the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, that's basically in the hands of Congress. So it would take another act of Congress to change those laws.
So they would speak directly to what is called the Sonny Bono laws? They would call their congressmen, their elected officials, and say, we would like to have that retracted?
Yes, the Sonny Bono Copyright Act and especially the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, because it's the one that affects the DVDs and whether you can take a Windows DVD and play it on Linux or not. So I think the country is only just beginning to see what these laws mean.
Do you have a website or a contact location?
I have a website at stromian.com. There is a page up there on open source software licensing that will explain some of this to you and show you copies of the different licenses. It really doesn't get into copyright and patent issues because that's not part of the work that my company does, at least directly. But it is a concern of mine, and the last chapter of my book on business practices and open source deals very directly with these problems.
Once again, you just mentioned your book. Could you give us the title of that again?
It's called Open Source, The Unauthorized White Papers.
And the publisher?
Publisher is IDG, which is now going by the name of Hungry Minds.
And I think the year that it was published?
This came out late last year.
And that would be 2000?
Yes. So the other thing I guess we can bring up that you should keep an eye on if you aren't aware of it and start noticing are the issues about software patents, which are growing. And the United States is now trying to persuade the European community to adopt our copyright laws and patent laws so that U.S. software patents can be enforced in Europe.
What is a software patent?
Formerly, software couldn't be patented because these were felt to be mathematical truths which were available to anyone who looked at nature and found them something like patenting the law of gravity. However, over the years, and really only in the last 10 or 15 years, people have started to obtain copyrights on things like business practices. And we have copyrights on all sorts of software now. The famous one, the Amazon buying a book with a single click, has been patented. And the patent was enforced against Barnes & Noble. On the Barnes & Noble site, if you order something, it'll say, click this button, be sure to click this button, because if you don't, your order won't take. And that's the second click that they're required to put in there, so you can't purchase with a single click.
Did you catch that? The single click has been patented. Are there other examples of the single click kind of technology being implemented?
Well, it's easy to find examples of absurd patents because basically the examiners are overwhelmed with patent applications. They are also graded on how efficient they are on disposing of the cases. They also know if they dispose by refusing a patent, they'll simply be dragged into court. And so it's much easier all the way around to simply grant the patent and let nature take its course down the line. The patent I like to use, because it has cute drawings with it, is the patent on the method of exercising a cat by means of a laser pointer.
And this has been patented. Okay, you heard it live here at the 2001 computer conference.
The whole issue of tightening intellectual property laws, I think, will eventually come more and more to public notice. You're hearing about it here on this radio station because this radio station is more aware of these issues, perhaps, than the general public. I hope that all the listeners will keep their eyes open and bring these things up with their congressmen as they notice the practical effects it's having in their lives.
And in reference to that, how is this tied up with the WTO and the globalization and the laws that are being implemented as we speak?
We got the DMCA because going way back to the Ron Brown days of the U.S. Commerce Department, we tried to sell the whole thing to the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, with the idea that when they adopted it, we could come back to the Congress and say, this is an international treaty that you need to ratify, and then the discussion would have been less. However, WIPO said that they couldn't stand the idea and roundly rejected it. So it was taken to Congress, which also turned it down. So the second pass through Congress was accompanied by a very heavy lobbying effort by Hollywood, the record industry, the movies, this sort of thing, so that they were able to get it through. And this was several years back, and nobody paid any attention at the time. And now it's beginning to catch up with us. As our entertainment becomes more digital, you'll see the effects more and more.
You said several years ago. When was it first initially brought up to WIPO?
Back in the days when Ron Brown was running the U.S. Commerce Department, which would be the early Clinton years. Originally, the movie industry thought it was invulnerable to copying and distribution, unauthorized copying and distribution, because the movies were so bulky. And they watched it happen to record albums. And they realized that with the progress in the computer industry, it was going to come to movies. And, of course, we have it now with these DVD discs, which are distributed even more efficiently through the DivX system, which was invented basically, what do we say, unofficially, homebrew. This is part of the power of the open source movement, is that so much development is taking place among users rather than corporations. So in order to control the distribution of these movies in digital form, the DMCA is the law that allows these software locks to be placed on the DVD discs or any other means of electronic distribution, and then makes it a felony to defeat them.
All right. Okay. Well, once again, we're speaking with
Don Rosenberg of Stromian Technologies.
And your book?
Open Source, The Unauthorized White Papers.
And this has been live at the Linux World Conference and Expo in downtown San Francisco at Moscone Center. Free Dimitri. For more information, http://freesklyarov.org or http://eff.org. O-R-G or http://anti-dmca.org. Free Dimitri. This has been Govinda Dalton here at the Moscone Center Linux World Conference and Expo.